You're listening to Lanyap, a weekly digest of news, personal finance, brotherly banter, and whatever else is on our minds. From Stokes Family Office.
All right, Lanyap Podcast, Doug and Greg Stokes, Stokes Family Office. A lot of choppiness and negative sentiment in the markets over the last week. Feels like it's overdue. It feels like we have been talking about when the next correction is going to come. We're about 3% off of high, so wouldn't get too excited about any sort of correction territory there, but definitely not a straight up and to the right move like we've had since October of 2023. It's been pretty amazing and unprecedented from a growth perspective over the last 6 months, and our first wobble really in 6 months is occurring now. A couple things on the front that are causing, I think in our opinion, causing this move. The first is the inflation data that came out last week is showing that inflation is getting a little bit more difficult to tame, and there's fears that there's going to be reinflation. We'll talk about that in a second, but what that leads to is expectations of interest rate cuts being pushed out further with one, maybe two cuts this year. There's also been talk about a potential hike this year. And so that has caused some anxiety in the markets. And then obviously what's going on in the Middle East and escalations between Iran and Israel, and obviously the continued escalation and confrontation in Ukraine is causing anxiety in markets. And so I think one of the first things we want to talk about today is just inflation, Greg. And there's a few posts that I've put into our show notes here that I think dispel the potential anxiety that people have that this is a 1970 style reinflation. I just don't think that if you look at the other methodologies in terms of inflation measurements, we're not in some sort of reignition of inflation where we're going to have a stagnant economy with high inflation. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's correct, and that's borne out in the data. Like if you look back at the 2022 inflation, basically everything was going up in price. We talked about eggs at that point in time, everything, airfares, used cars, et cetera, et cetera. The primary drivers for inflation in the most recent report were auto insurance and housing. Everything else basically is moderating. Not everything else, but to a large degree, everything's moderating except for those two. So you would think that if everything's moving in the right direction, those two could moderate as well too.
Here's the data. I mean, this is from Charlie Bolello CPI report from March. Shelter at 5.7% growth. I went and looked at apartmentlist.com, which tracks rents on a monthly basis. This is Apartment List. It says rents are up 0.6% month over month, down 0.8% year over year. So if you look at the CPI report of shelter, which is largely rent, at 5.7% growth of the last year, that's a lagging indicator compared to real-time data, down 0.8% year over year. Shelter making up about 40% of CPI, a 6.5% difference between negative 0.8% and positive 0.5.7%. That's your difference in basically a 2% inflation rate, which is the Fed's target, and the 3.5% number, which came in last week. So
yeah, on the housing side of the equation, there was a huge during 2021, 2022, there was a huge boom in multifamily residential building. And like what's happened over the last year and a half, 2 years is interest rates. And we talked about this a ton, but interest rates have gone up and the price of construction materials has also gone up. And basically it's become uneconomical to develop multifamily. That's borne out in the data as well too. So we had what we're going to see and what we are seeing is that because there was a huge boom in the development of multifamily over the last or 2 or 3 years ago, those are starting to come online and rents are coming down. But what will be interesting to see is that multifamily starts as of the last most recent report are at like a 10-year low. So maybe in 2 or 3 years, we'll have actual inflation
Yeah, we'll be talking about shelter as a real issue, as a from an inflation perspective, and maybe other things are pulling it down.
Right, but right now it's to your point. It makes no sense that the prime that's a primary factor in the calculus for the Fed, but it's in actuality it's almost like in a disinflationary cycle on the housing side of the equation. It is expensive to own a house, though. Obviously, if you're one of the unfortunate ones that doesn't have a 3% or a 4% mortgage or a 2% mortgage, buying a house nowadays at a 7 right now, mortgage rates are at a 2024 high at like 7.4%. And we talked about this last week, that homeowners insurance is ridiculously expensive in certain areas of the country, specifically like New Orleans and Florida and California, Hawaii, anywhere that has any sort of natural disaster issues. That's certainly a problem, but certainly on the rents, it's not a big deal. And then the vast majority of people, something like 75% of people, have mortgage rates that are in like the 3.5 to 4% rate on average. And nobody is selling those houses because you've got, what are you going to trade up for some people? I remember you talked about this a while back, that you were talking with a client who wants to downsize, but their monthly note would double or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, people are stuck.
Right.
This is from Scott Granis, of Calafia Beach Pundit. And this is another just disinflation, data point. First things first is, the producer's price index and survey of purchasing managers. Basically the economy is growing at a tepid pace. So it's not like we're in some sort of hot economy right now. We're getting a slowdown in economic growth due to higher interest rates. And then he also says that this is chart number two, number of firms reporting paying higher prices continues to decline. There was a big spike in 2021 and 2022 that has declined since late 2022. So firms the input costs are coming down. And as input costs come down, obviously, then the price of goods can come down to the end user. And so if you look at just general prices of goods and services, if you look at housing prices, rents, everything's coming down, and interest rates are really driving a lot of that. The interesting thing that people the counter, I think, to this is that the concern around refinancing from the government's perspective, refinancing old lower interest rate debt with new high interest rate debt. I think that is a concern, that if you have a 1% and 2% treasury bill that comes due and you have to refinance at 5%, the cost of interest is going to escalate. And I believe it's estimated to cost over the next couple of years greater than $1 trillion annually in interest expense, which is larger than the entire defense budget. But the counter to that is that they're expected to cut rates in the next year. And so if we go down from 5.5% to 4.5% or lower, then I think that's a non sequitur. We'll have a period of high interest expense from a government perspective, followed by a normalization of that expense. And so anyway, I don't think we're in some sort of debt doom loop, as some of the pundits have been saying. I don't think inflation is getting out of control. The data just doesn't suggest that. It will be interesting to see what happens in 2 or 3 years when nobody is able to develop anything right now. What does inflation look like in housing in 27? That would be
right. So we have a housing shortage in this country, and that's only going to be exacerbated over time. To your point about the people calling for this sort of debt doom loop, we've talked about this as well too, that assets are at an all-time high and net worth is assets minus liabilities. So even though the national debt is high, the fact of the matter is that stock prices are at 3 or 4% off all-time highs. Housing is very near all-time highs. Basically, the American economy is in really good shape. And the dollar, with all this geopolitical tension that's going on, the dollar, people were calling, just like people were calling for this sort of debt apocalypse or whatever, people were calling for the end to the U.S. dollar. And that's really been proven absolutely wrong. There's no other option really. TINA to the US dollar. I mean, what are you going to train if you're transacting internationally? You're going to go and deal with the yuan or whatever, or the
stable coins.
Yes, right. There's really no option. So basically, the US dollar is at or near all-time highs relative to other currencies. It's making it such that U.S. companies that sell goods internationally that have to bring their money and convert it back to U.S. dollars are going to get negatively impacted because it's expensive to convert money back to U.S. dollars. But on the other hand, if you're traveling internationally, it's really inexpensive on a relative basis. Americans are at, so I saw a recent chart that Americans planning to travel internationally over the next year is at an all-time high. It's like 26% of Americans have a trip planned to go abroad in the next 12 months. So it's really that I find that fascinating. And just relative to the American consumer, this is a chart from Jeff Winger, average annual wage of a U.S. worker relative to other countries. Basically in the year 2000, the American employee or American worker was making roughly the same amount on an average basis as a UK employee at like $40,000 a year, German slightly less, French slightly less, et cetera, kind of all in the same ballpark. Italy has always been a laggard. But if you look at it on a relative basis now, the average annual wage in 2024 for a US worker is $77,000 a year versus the UK at $50,000 a year, Germany at $46,000, France at $44,000, Italy at $32,000. Japan at 27. So the U.S. that's real. I find this really interesting because that's kind of, I wonder if you did a side by side of this, of these countries stock markets relative to the United States, it would look a lot pretty similar as well too. But it's the U.S. worker is doing really strong. And another thing that's happened over that same period of time is we used to be in a situation, and a lot of our older listeners will remember this, obviously in the 70s, where we had major oil shortages, and that's really one of the sort of counter arguments that we could have a sort of stagflationary period like in the 70s if this Middle Eastern thing blows up and price of oil goes through the roof, etc. But that's neither here nor there. But back in the 70s, we were a net importer of oil and gas by a power of 1.5 or something like that, meaning we imported 2 barrels of oil for every 1 barrel we exported. And now over the last 10 years or so with the technological advances related to fracking, we've actually become a net exporter of energy by a power of 1. So, just really, amazing what's happened to the U.S. worker, to the dollar, to energy over the last 10, 15, 20 years. And the United States has really become a powerhouse. The dollar has become a powerhouse, and I really don't see the sort of doom. I mean, anything can happen, but it doesn't seem to me that that's a real credible argument. But we shall see, of course.
Yeah, and this is just to further cement that that argument. This is Urban Carmel. He says we're not in a 1970s style oil inflation spiral. Energy's importance has more than halved, and today's real gas prices are 30% lower than the 1981 peak. So to think about that, we're using more oil, but because of technological advances, oil has become cheaper on a absolute and real basis. So 30% lower prices than 1981, inflation adjusted. Gasoline prices really haven't moved in. This goes back to 1970. Gasoline prices were $4 a gallon in the 70s and 80s. They're less than $4 a gallon now. I mean, it's just unbelievable. The amount of energy consumption has continued to escalate, but we found new and innovative ways to extract more oil and to become more efficient. And we talked about this. This is probably a month or two ago, about how we're just continuing to grow economic output. But companies, by virtue of wanting to become more efficient, by wanting to use less energy because energy is expensive, have basically innovated their way out of an issue and reliance upon massive uses of fossil fuels. Coming back to the markets, I wanted to get something from Ryan Dietrich in here. He basically, he's somebody we could, I think, every week. He puts great charts out, and he mentioned, this is a chart from that he posted from Frank Capillary. He said, S&P 500 broke the trend line from late October. This is a nice one from Frank Capillary on what could be next. And so we've been talking about, when is this next correction going to come? Capillary has a good chart here on the past three times that the S&P has broken a positive trend line, going back to early 2023, late 2022. The first one, we went peak to trough 6%, then second peak to trough 6.6%. The third one peaked to trough 7.2%. So last three times we've had sort of a disruption in this bull market since late 2022, October of 2022. We've gotten these 6 to 7% corrections. We're basically halfway there right now. So we'll see what happens with this one. But
and we get like 3-5%, 5 to 10% corrections a year on average. So this is not abnormal. You get 1-10% of correction every year on average. 20% correction every 2 or 3 years. And if you look back at this whole, I found this so interesting. I love markets, and I love just any type of market, really. But the interesting thing about cryptocurrency is it's just basically a speculative asset, meaning like there's no actual, at least for now, there's no functional use case for it besides people are using it to gamble on, it's basically a gauge of people's fear or greed in any particular situation. And what happened on Saturday while I was winding down and watching the Masters, which I'll make a quick segue. I saw that this was the lowest Masters viewership over the last decade or something like that. People are not watching the Masters anymore, or golf in general. There's not a lot of excitement with the field that
without Tiger.
But anyway, I was watching, as I was winding down, watching the Masters on Saturday, the news broke that Iran launched like 300 projectiles at Israel as a retaliation for Israel killing some generals. And long and short of it is that the actual outcome of the attack, if you haven't seen it, basically there was one little girl that was wounded by a missile that fell out of the sky, was shot down, fell out of the sky, and there was slight damage to a military base in Israel. But when that actually happened, the news broke before the markets knew that it was generally speaking, not a major attack or whatever. The price of Bitcoin was down 10% immediately. And then it recovered by the next day. It was basically where it was before the news broke. And then, interestingly enough, if you would have told me, and this is the sort of crazy and interesting thing about the markets, if you would have told me if there was going to be if Iran was going to shoot 300 missiles and drones or whatever at Israel, and what would I think would be the outcome in the markets the next day? Well, I'd say the markets would open up down substantially, and then oil would be way up because something like 37% of the world's oil passes through like the Strait of Hormuz.
And the 10-year treasury would be down.
And the there'd be a flight. Exactly. And the 10-year treasury would be down because people would be like, this is Armageddon, you know, worst scenario possible, et cetera. And what ended up happening was the markets opened up like 0.5% on Monday positively, oil was down, and the 10-year treasury yield was up. So meaning like exactly the opposite of what if you had to, and this is why markets are so hard and trying to trade on any sort of information is so hard, because any reasonable mind would basically say, if you're going to try to bet on short-term movements, you would be completely wrong on all three of those. Even if you had the foreknowledge of there would be an attack and you try to bet against that or bet on that, then you would lose on all 3 points, which I think is fascinating. So it's really sort of, And if you look back at the sort of trajectory of the markets for the last, we had this chart in our office for a while, this old Morningstar chart, and this Andex is what it's called. And if you look back at the, this is basically tracks the S&P 500 or the Dow Jones Industrial Average from like the 1920s until 2023 or 2024 or whatever. And it references over that period of time, major geopolitical or world events like World War II, the Great Depression, assassination of Kennedy, et cetera. It's the Gulf War in the 90s, all these major events over the course of the last 100 years, and the reaction of the markets. But it really puts it in these sort of geopolitical events into context, because what's happened is, of course, there's a general reaction to the markets because it's new news, and then people extrapolate that on the prices of securities. But all along, the markets have chugged, upwards and to the right. It's anyone's guess, obviously, what can happen in this particular case. But if history is any guide, we're probably going to be talking about something else in 6 or 12 months. Besides this, of course, this could spiral or whatever, like anything else. And that's why we're in the 4% correction, and extrapolate, because Israel is projected to do some other sort of retribution to the Iranian retribution. But the likelihood is that if history is any guide, this is going to be something we're not talking about in 6 or 12 months.
That's it. So with that, we're going to wrap up this week. I think basically the messaging here is everybody's horrible at forecasting, so why try to do it? And that goes with inflation and interest rates as well. And we'll wrap with what Urban Carmel said. He said a year ago, the FOMC, which is the Fed, was widely expected to start cutting rates in July of 2023. Now the first cut may not take place until autumn of 2024. During this time, the S&P 500 is up 30%. Number one, we are objectively terrible at forecasting. And number two, widely acceptable notions of cross-asset correlations are wrong. Basically, what people were saying at the time was that we need rate cuts for the market to move higher. We haven't gotten rate cuts. The market's moved substantially higher. The last thing I'll say here is also from Colin Roche. He says, the good news is that this means that we're going to be able to get 18 to 24 months of 5% money market and T-bill rates now that rate cuts are getting pushed back. So savers are in hog heaven here, as they can safely plan for up to 2 years of expenses with 5% expected returns. That's glorious. So anyway, we hope everybody has a great week. It's Lanyap Podcast. Tell your friends about us and give us a 5-star review.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Lanyap. This podcast is brought to you by Stokes Family Office. If you liked this episode, consider sharing it with a friend. You can subscribe to future episodes in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information about Stokes Family Office and Lanyap, visit us at stokesfamilyoffice.com. The information in this podcast is educational and general in nature and does not take into consideration the listener's personal circumstances. Therefore, it is not intended to be a substitute for specific, individualized financial, legal, or tax advice. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a final decision.